Hello, and welcome to another episode of Adventures on the Can-Do podcast. I'm your host, Jothi Rosenberg, a.k.a. The Incorrigible Entrepreneur. A professor turned entrepreneur and founder of 9 startup companies, on this show, I talk with business leaders and personal achievers. Adventures on the Can-Do explores the challenges and rewards of entrepreneurship, overcoming adversity, and where grit and perseverance can get you. Be inspired by others and push yourself along your path to success and fulfillment. My forthcoming book, Think Like a Startup Founder, based on my experiences, good and bad, seeks to help early-stage startup founders avoid the oh-so-many pitfalls founders can experience along the way. Adventures on the Can-Do adds to that the stories of many other founders, each with an amazing story and set of lessons learned that will be valuable to listeners. Before we jump into today's episode, just a reminder of how you can support this podcast. You can go to my website, jothirosenberg.com, and sign up for my newsletter, and there you can also see other episodes of this podcast. Also, please follow and rate us at podchaser.com, Adventures on the Can Do. And with that behind us, let me introduce today's guest, Jesse Resch. Jesse has over a decade of experience driving transformation at startups, unicorns, and enterprise companies. She is a Terra.do Climate Fellow member, a member of the Soil Health Committee at B Carbon, entrepreneur in residence at Antler, a global venture firm, and 3X startup executive, having led her prior company to number 10 in financial services on the 2023 Inc. 5000 list, which recognizes companies for high growth. Jesse is the founder and CEO of Downland, a startup that aims to remove barriers for a new generation of regenerative farmers and ranchers. And please meet Jesse.
Hey, Jothi, how are you?
I'm good. Nicest headphones I've seen yet, just so you know.
Thank you. I asked for them in particular so I could look cool when I go to the airport. And because they have the jack that you can like watch movies on, but nice. Mostly I wanted to be a who's who at the airport.
they're not Skull Candy, are they?
No. They're Urbanista is the brand. I actually worked with a wonderful boss who worked at did marketing at Skull Candy. So don't tell him I don't have his headphones.
So that's really funny because my niece that I just last month was out skiing with in Park City, where she lives, is the head of global marketing for Skull Candy.
Oh, yeah. He might know her. He had that role. Some version of that role years ago.
Well, let's jump in. I can't wait to get some of your story out here for people to hear. I always like to start with, where are you from originally and where are you residing now?
Yeah, I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio, born and raised. I'm ashamed I'm not my family for not going to The Ohio State University as a result of that. But after a series of moves, I live in Austin, Texas now, and when I go home, I tend to go home to Cincinnati, which is where my husband's family is.
So, but at least what you just did correctly for all the people in Ohio is you said The Ohio State. You know, I'm from Michigan, and we don't say The University of Michigan. So, you know, you guys are just cooler.
Yeah, they teach it in the school systems, I think.
My wife is from Dayton, so there's everyone in her family is a Buckeye. So let's start talking about sort of your career before the current startup. We'll get to that soon, but you know, along the way, what sort of doors were closed in your career and how did that help you make, you know, some of the transitions that you had to make?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were, as I've gotten older, perhaps, or have been better at reflecting, or the signs that I should be doing something new or more obvious. I've run into a lot of closed doors in my career that have made it very obvious where the next move is. The first very open door was through a leadership program at Fifth Third Bank. Should I avoid name brands, or should
no.
I, do you have a preference?
No. Especially okay. Cool. Saying nice things about an Ohio financial institution like Fifth Third Bank.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. My husband would joke when he worked at Muir Woods that he could always tell the Midwesterners, because they'd pay with their Midwest bank cards, Fifth Third and PNC and US Bank. And there's a huge collection of banking talent and experiences in that part of the country and in Southwest Ohio. Lots of people have circled through different institutions there. But that opportunity came through an open door with a family and a warm introduction through a family I had the privilege of getting to know while volunteering there, and was there for about 5 years between college internships and time in my career there. The doors closed there intentionally as part of the program. You had to rotate every 6 months into a new role. So it was like, you have this very short window to climb up this learning curve and achieve results. And that's your shot. So got really good at learning new things very quickly, from managing a $5 million P&L as my very first job to managing a team of 20 plus temps in a call center, most of which were much older than me, and how to earn respect and earn trust in a very short window.
Did they teach you how to manage, or did they just throw you into the deep end?
Yes and yes. We had the opportunity to go to a lot of different types of courses and do coursework, and particularly around coaching. And I think when you go to those classes, there's tends to be some element of role play that can feel a little contrived or cheesy. But I sincerely got a lot out of leaning into that experience, being like, okay, I'm here in the class for these 2 or 3 days. I'm going to do the thing. And it's become a cornerstone of the way that I coach when I think about or mentoring, asking questions and helping people discover what they want. Because ultimately, being a coach is not about like asserting what you want for people. It's about helping them understand what they want themselves and helping them take the small steps to get to that next piece.
Yeah.
From there, I can keep going too. From there, I moved over to General Electric. They had opened a huge facility in downtown Cincinnati along the riverbank there, as that area was sort of up and coming. That's another kind of plug for Cincinnati. I think it is an underrated city, and a lot of people I talk to who don't have a great impression of it, haven't been there in the last 15 years. I'm like, well, take a trip to Cincinnati. I think it'll surprise you. But was at GE for a number of years, had the opportunity to rotate through a couple roles and do a ton of international travel. I could have a whole separate diatribe on the value of international travel and the impact of that. But moved to, after a couple of years there, moved to California when my husband was taking this huge risk. He had been at his company for 10 plus years, very established, very credible there. One of those people that you ask how to do things because he's done pretty much every job in the company. And he felt stuck. And similar to something I hear a lot of people when they're going through these career changes, he was like, I think I can be doing more. And he applied to this program that had accepted 25 out of 10,000 applicants. We're like, there's no way he's going to get in this. Like, I'm just tossing my hat in the ring. And he got it. He got the call. He was pulled into this program.
But you never doubted. Also, you never doubted, right?
I always supported. I'll say it that way. But those odds aren't great. And so in the face of that, it's very obvious that, like, you should take that chance when you've have achieved over these crazy odds. So we're like, okay, are we moving to California? Yeah. And we up and moved everything. Actually, I was interviewing at the time, and that manager of mine who had formerly been at Skull Candy, I remember he interviewed me and was like, what do you think about taking risks? And I said, I'm moving to San Francisco in 3 weeks, whether you give me this job or not. And I got that job. So we both landed in California, and a few weeks later, the program was acquired and shut down, which was a sigh of disappointment. We mourned that time and had to figure out what the next thing was for him.
So 25 out of 10,000, he gets in, and then some short number of weeks or months later, it's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. We actually saw, he met the founder of the company in a park near where we lived at one point. He was like there with his family, and he apologized profusely to him. But it was a thing that felt like a very closed door at the time, obviously. Like, you can't have a job that doesn't exist. You can't have a job that you don't get the interview for. And so it's like, well, that's clearly, there's still a grieving process to go through, but that's clearly not the path we're meant to be on. So he bounced around through a few different things and ended up taking another immersive in data science and was on his way. During that time, that I had converted or transitioned into startups. And so I was on this B2B SaaS, like, what is the playbook there? How does that work? And learning all the basics of, you know, customer acquisition costs and lifetime value and ARR, all the acronyms and what they mean and why they're important. And you know, what a Series A, B, and C is. And it started to really get some good basics from there.
Did any catastrophes happen while you were in California? Loaded question.
Besides the job itself, we were in California in 2017 or 2018 and 2019. And one of the experiences that we had while we were there was the campfire in Paradise, California occurred. And we went through those were mask wearing days. In a pre-pandemic world, so had that sort of adjustment, but also had this huge experience with wildfire that was, while the cause of it was ultimately related to utilities and other sort of factors, was certainly exacerbated by climate issues that were keeping the land very dry, keeping winds high, making it difficult for that fire to be tamed. And I think when I talk to, I'm sure we'll get to talk more about my transition into climate, and I think into the climate space and why that has pulled me through the lens of food. But when I think about how climate change affects us every day, it tends to expose itself in weather events, like our experience with the campfire. I mentioned I live in Austin. Like, 100 days over 100 degrees last summer. Or friends I've met in Texas from Houston have various like hurricane stories, and all those extreme events, they're definitely the doom and gloom side of the climate that can make you want to participate in making a change, or can make at least make it very clear that you need to adapt, whether that's like different windows on your home, different timing your travel outside of hurricane season, and thinking about the climate more regularly in your everyday life.
So let's offline. You mentioned to me something that I'm hoping you'll explain more fully, which is you said work sucks.
Doesn't it?
Well, some kinds of work sucks. I mean,
yeah.
But why don't you tell us what you meant?
Yeah, I think it's aligned to this theme of following the open door. Some people might call that following your intuition. I don't know that I'm really great at following my intuition just yet. So, you know, avoiding the closed doors and following the open ones is how I get there. And I think when I felt that tension in the workplace of like, man, this is not a role I want to be doing, or especially as a young female in banking in this kind of like very male dominated sector, showing up into rooms and in energy as well at General Electric, showing up in rooms and being the only woman there, and being like, oh, I have to prove myself a little bit. And in that effort to prove myself, I would work really hard to do things I was capable of, but not great at. And that sucks when you have to do things. It's a necessary part of life to do things that aren't fun. But it's an exhausting life when you have to do things that aren't fun and you aren't good at most of the time. And as part of some of the training I got to do in my banking career and in my management training programs, I was exposed to StrengthsFinder as a paradigm of how we can manage people. The TLDR, or the short version of what StrengthsFinder is that you'll be more engaged at your work if you can spend more time doing the things that you like and you're naturally good at. And I am excited in what I'm building at Downland to be able to do more of that for myself and for the people that we hope to bring on the team as we grow.
Okay, you mentioned Downland. Let's get into that. So first of all, I guess, why don't you tell everybody, the listeners, what it is, and then I really want to understand how the idea came about, where you've been in banking and you've been doing a variety of other things. And you've mentioned food, you've mentioned climate. So can you show us that path?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's where I'm going to start a different train of thought there. Downland is a marketplace that helps match the next generation of climate smart farmers and ranchers with land to start their operation. We're involved in that farm operation over the long term by providing them with training and helping them access blended capital, things like grants and loans, and navigating those processes that they need to start and sustain their business. When I say climate smart, which is sort of a new-ish term that started to be used for a type of agriculture called regenerative agriculture, which again is its own debated term, but at the core is a series of principles that are meant to improve the health of the soil as part of the overall ecosystem. And when you improve the soil, if you remember the food chain, the nutrients in the soil get in our food and get into us. So when you're taking care of that ecosystem from the bottom up, it translates into much more nutrient-dense food, which has incredible health impacts for people when you're eating eating that whole food diet. And coming back to some of the other benefits, the land that is well stewarded there are many better other benefits to improving the biodiversity on that land. When it does rain a lot, that land has become more of a sponge to absorb it rather than hard concrete that water runs off, making you more flood resistant and allowing the soil to store more water in times of drought. And so those are the very high level definitions of what downland is and what regenerative agriculture is. And I'm certainly leaving out a lot of nuance to both, but I got on that journey from a longer story of figuring out how to live a healthy life for as long as possible. When I was 16, that summer, I bought my first car with my ice cream shop job money. It was a 1995 Chrysler LeBaron. And since I was mobile, I was involved in helping take care of my grandparents as they were aging. You know, feeding, changing clothing, the whole deal. And one of the things that really instilled in me was like, man, I don't want the aging process to be like this for me. I don't want to need this kind of help, or at least not till the very end. And so had this very strong resolve to learn about how to achieve that. And that has taken a lot of forms over my lifetime of very small incremental changes from, you know, maybe I shouldn't drink so much pop, which is also a very Midwest way to say it. What do you say? Do you say soda?
Well,
or do you say pop?
I grew up saying pop because Michigan says pop, but you get laughed at enough when you live in Boston and say pop, or they won't actually know what to get you. So we've learned not to say it, but I do know what it means.
Good. Where do they say in Boston? Is it just soda? Is it a name brand of some kind? Okay.
Oh, they'll say Coke, Pepsi. I mean, or generically a soda.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, things like that, taking, removing some of that extra sugar, learning how to cook at home, which is a really underrated and dying skill. And have pulled that thread into all kinds of different athletic pursuits as well, CrossFit, weightlifting, and certainly where your food comes from. And in the pursuit of understanding where our food comes from, came to connect with friends of ours who are running a regenerative operation in Seguin, just outside of Austin, about 40 minutes southeast of here. And saw what they were doing. And it was incredible, just mind-blowing to see how their land had been changing and see the photos they were posting online and see it come from brown dirt that just blew away in the wind to this really lush space that's loved and taken care of. And I knew that I had these business skills of operating in marketplaces, two- and three-sided marketplaces, as well as just having been through a lot of different business stages from employee number 7 to employee number like 80 into the enterprise, and saw that there were possibly opportunities to use this startup model to accelerate the adoption of regenerative agriculture. And that's what Downland is helping to work towards by equipping this workforce that has a deep desire to participate in this kind of change.
So you mentioned that you were you became an athlete. I mean, maybe you've always been an athlete, but it sounds like you got more focused on it. Do you think that helps you when it comes to a startup?
Certainly. I wouldn't have said I was an athlete maybe even like 3 years ago. As part of those healthy pursuits after college, I just started doing distance running because I didn't know what else to be doing. So got a few half marathons and trail runs and relay races under my belt, neighborhood 5Ks, stuff like that. I transitioned into doing CrossFit after my husband sort of lured me in around 2016 and have been doing that ever since. Have pulled up, picked up some other hobbies along the way, including Olympic weightlifting. And I've had some really exciting accomplishments that I'm really pleased with over the last year athletic wise, including I'm a CrossFit level 2 trainer. I got to participate at the Fittest Experience with a team, which is a pretty large scale event here in Texas. And also participated in the Texas State Weightlifting Championships in my age and weight bracket and took 5th in the state. And those are all things that I didn't necessarily set out to do or even really consider that I was capable of. And along the way have learned some really interesting things. In particular, this idea of resilience, which I would always probably have said I'm a gritty and resilient person, but grit and resilience that also endures. The Fittest Experience was an event that me and my team qualified for 7 months before the big event. And so we had this long training cycle of not just like, can I show up in the gym today and work really hard for this like 7 to 15 minute workout? Like that takes some level of grit and resilience to like get yourself out of bed, like get yourself there and like put your best effort forward. But, you know, once you've done it, if you miss the next day or miss maybe a couple days and get off your routine, you can always certainly get back on it. But it feels a little more impactful when you have this really big task looming. And I think a startup feels that way very much. There's especially when you're employee number one and you're just sort of grinding every day on what the tasks are that you need. And you're not just trying to accomplish the tasks of today. I think as someone with an operations background, it's very easy to be like, I need to deliver these tasks today, this report, this, you know, this set of emails, this outreach, you know, generate this content, whatever it is that needs done. And as a founder, you also need to think about what are the things I need to be ready for next week, next month, next year. The trajectory of your problem solving stretches out significantly. And getting ready for this competition had a similar experience of like, wow, I have to not just show up today, but I have to show up tomorrow and the day after and the day after. And that means, you know, 12-hour days are necessary from time to time, but they're not sustainable when you're thinking on the horizon of like months and years. So building a resilience and a grit that endures through a long training cycle or a long fundraise cycle, which is what I'm living and breathing right now, is a skill that I think athletes can certainly bring to the table when it comes to achieving long-term things, but in particular, working in the startup space.
So where do you think, you made it sound like you were already gritty. Where do you think that your grit originally came from? I mean, it's not like, you were in Columbus. I mean, Columbus is a, you know, nice place. So You didn't have hardship. I'm guessing you didn't have hardship as a kid. Where do you think the grit that you just talked about a minute ago prior to the startup came from?
That's a great question. And yeah, I would say I've certainly always had a very high level of independence. I was someone who, my grandparents did a lot of our caretaking growing up, and I regularly would just be outside by myself climbing trees or like running away in the neighborhood. There was a gas station somewhere in their neighborhood where we could get like Starburst, and I would be like, yeah, I'm going to get Starburst, like no big deal. And my grandparents were like, you're running away, like you can't just leave. You can't just leave, like you are 6 years old. So certainly always had this really strong sense of independence. And I remember one of the things that I think about often is when I first had this sort of realization of like what of that death exists and like kind of what it means, or at least the way you can understand it when you're 8 years old. I laid in my bed and I held my breath and closed my eyes. And I was like, wow, is this what being dead is like? Is this what it means? And that's a whole separate maybe conversation about how that perspective has evolved. But I have had an awareness of my mortality for what feels like a very long time. And I think this just ticking clock of like, man, life is short and you don't get another shot at it. And let's make sure we can do really big and awesome things and like squeeze all the juice out of life that there is. I had the opportunity through Antler, which is a venture capital accelerator that runs cohorts around the world, but recently ran one in Austin that I was part of, and connected with folks who are in this death tech space, which was a space I didn't really have a name for or knew existed. But as I've been reflecting on the kind of impact that I want to have with my company and some of the things that I want to pursue, I'm finding that there's a pocket of people that have this reflection, meditation, practice, awareness of their mortality in a way that like really drives them. And that might be a little bit of a bummer, but I think that there people in that space really have a compassion for end of life reflection and what it can actually mean in terms of motivating us to keep going in life.
So everybody's heard of fintech. There's med tech, but you're the first that's ever used the term death tech in front of me.
I don't know that I have a big appreciation for the full breadth of the space, but it's something that's new to my radar. I think a lot of death tech companies are around like end of life planning, end of life reflection. I actually, at a previous company, worked on a deal that was purchasing machinery for people to turn their remains into diamonds, and for that to be like a gift for their family members. But yeah, it's a relatively new and emerging space, as far as I understand it. But that's been my introduction to it, and if nothing else, I'm glad that my that I have other people out there who are viewing end of life not as something to fear, but as something to like motivate you to what you want to achieve.
Well, let's okay. Enough about death. Let's go back to
if we're going to talk about farms, there's going to be some death there too. Maybe we'll see.
Okay, so I do want to go back to farming. two things that I can think of right now that I'd love to hear a little bit more about. One is You told me once that you felt like farms are like startups, and I could sort of see that. I mean, other than the huge factory farms, farms are small businesses, sure. Did you mean, is there more to it than in your mind than that sort of, it's a small business? What else is there that you're thinking? Mm.
Yes. And I think especially going along this first time founder journey in this space, those comparisons have been more salient because I'm feeling some of the things that I hear farmers and ranchers tell me as I've been speaking with them and doing customer discovery. And there's a few ways that I'll say that it's similar. Farming is one of the professions has a very high suicide rate. Sorry to bring us back to death, but there's it's a little known fact that it has a very high suicide rate among farmers, and there's certainly mental health challenges that come with being a founder as well, in terms of finding that grit, finding that persistence, having your identity very wrapped up in the success of your business in a way that farmers and ranchers, I think, really resonate with. They tell beautiful and poignant stories about their families, about their history, about the legacy they want to leave. And I hear a lot of founders resonate with this idea of legacy, with this idea of, and the loneliness and difficulty of trying to solve big problems by yourself. And I put a big stake in the ground for myself that we're not solving problems by ourselves. I am not an expert in farming, and that's why I need to be really great at building good teams around me to make sure that that expertise is on our team. And we've successfully done that. Our extended advisory team has over 90 years of ranching and farming experience under their belt, and they're going to really get to shine as we get into planning our first season, as we get past fundraising. One of the other ways that I think a farm is like a startup is just in terms of their basic needs. So we talked about this idea of like capital and fundraising. We've talked about this and sort of land as an important capital input for a farm. This need for training and community. And I think one other thing that startup founders and farmers perhaps have in common is what I'll call like eating your vegetables. customer within the founder, within starting a startup, at the early days, you spend a lot of time talking to your customers. And by the way, if you don't love talking to your customers, you're probably in the wrong business. Fortunately, I love talking to my customers. I love hearing their stories. And I also can see in both founders and farmers this excitement about what they're doing in a way that can perhaps disconnect them from the problems they're solving. So I'll give the startup example. A startup founder may have this incredible piece of technology that's really cool and really cutting edge. But if it doesn't solve a real problem for the customer, you don't have a market there. In the same way, you know, farmers can grow things that are beautifully tasty and beautifully like nutritious, but if your end customer doesn't know how to cook a patty pan squash, you suddenly don't have a great market. And I think there's places to learn about and regularly communicate what customers want and need, and how to introduce that into the ways they already live and work and behave today. You know, trying to convince a lot of people that they need to eat more carrots is great, but it's really hard because on a practical level, a working parent is going to eat food in a really different way when they're like crunched on a budget or crunched for time. And so I think food businesses that can understand the needs and behaviors of companies, of families and consumers today can help us better connect to our food and connect where it comes from, but also in a way that's practical and lets people, you know, take advantage of these types of products and eat the way they already eat. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Hey, speaking of fundraising, you introduced me to an organization, a way of raising money that's like sort of crowdsourcing for a startup. And you were pretty convincing because as soon as we hung up, I invested in your company. So tell everybody about it, would you?
Yeah, certainly. And thank you for investing.
Oh, listen, it was just $100. I don't want anyone to think that I did some major investment. But the cool thing is that I could invest just $100 in.
Yes.
And you get a few thousand people that do that, and you're off and running. So this is a new thing. I mean, I've raised a lot of money from a different kind of organizations, and I'd never seen this before. So, yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah. I'll tell the history as best I know it with regard to crowdfunding. In 2012, the Jobs Act or Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act triggered this series of rule changes related to capital formation, registration, and other disclosure laws that are monitored by the SEC. And one of the things that it did explicitly was create exemptions for security offerings or equity investments to be done by the everyday person. So prior to this type of vehicle existing or this style of fundraising existing, investing in startups was something that was not available to a lot of people. You know, if you didn't meet the accredited angel investor status, which is $1 million in net worth above and beyond your home, or 2 to 3 years of $200,000 of household income, or $300,000 with a spouse, you couldn't have the opportunity to invest in companies like Downland. And that leaves a lot of people out. And I'm excited because of the way that Downland can improve our food systems at a regional and local level over the long term of what we're doing, to have regular, just everyday people participating in what we're doing. It's not only sort of a fun way to invest, though admittedly highly speculative. And, you know, with any investment, people have to weigh those risks based on their own risk appetite. But, you know, you can vote with your dollars about the kinds of companies that you want to see exist and perpetuate. And I think that is a really exciting way for us to bring the future forward. And yeah, the crowdfund kind of has gotten a bad rap in the past from the venture capital space, but platforms like WeFunder have alleviated some of those concerns. One, because they manage a lot of the paperwork and filings to ensure compliance and help protect consumers from illegitimate companies, but also package all of the investors, those thousands of people, into a single special purpose vehicle that is issuing the security, whatever form it happens to be in. For Downland, we're raising on a pre-money safe. And so it takes the process of crowdfunding has evolved since its inception and become a lot less of the like messiness that it maybe was in the early days through platforms like WeFunder, creating some simplification and ease on the cap table while still enabling a lot of people to participate.
So you've mentioned it twice. Just want to make it clear to listeners. So what Downland is using is WeFunder, and we'll put the exact link to your spot on WeFunder in the show notes. So we'll make sure we get that exact link. So if just
Absolutely.
people can go look at it and see if they want to participate.
Yeah, I would say at minimum, everyone should go to the page and watch the video we have. It's chills guaranteed.
Well, that's
So I'm really.
that video is exactly why I decided to click the button and put $100 in. Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it does a really good job of explaining kind of the boldness that we're bringing to this problem and sharing some of the voices of people who've been on this project and really feel the need that we're meeting to help the next generation of farmers and ranchers get started in a way that's mindful of the future of our planet.
Well, I think you've been, this has been a phenomenal discussion. Is there any sort of last thing you would like to add to this episode?
I don't think so. I think we did it all. I think we, at least in so much as we can right now, this is a very, the founder journey is one of resilience and grit in a way that is hard to explain. And I hope that your listeners who are on this journey feel encouraged to not be alone in that. And I also hope that people who are considering that journey, I should take a version of a step towards it. There's as difficult as it is, it will stretch you in ways that are unimaginable and require a lot of growth. And if that's something you have an appetite for and have the means to go without a salary for a little bit, or at least explore this space, I think it really teaches a lot of valuable skills and a lot of grit and resilience, and is one I've never met anyone say they regret taking.
I agree with that. In fact, it's true even of startups that don't have, incredible outcomes, because the process is what I call joyful. It's just that there's no other word for it that I can think of.
And
Well,
I'm glad to meet a lot of people on this journey. You meet when you become a founder and you have the appetite to do that, you if you are mindful of avoiding the pit of loneliness, you'll meet a lot of really smart, interesting, gritty people along the way, and they're probably your people.
yep, they are. Well, thank you very much. This has been fantastic. That's going to be a wrap for today. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Adventures on the Can-Do. Please share and like us on your social media channels. This is Jothi Rosenberg, and I'll be back with a new episode every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget to check out the show notes for additional resources and links. Hasta la vista.